home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson, your host. I want to thank Garrett Miller for executive producing this show. And a special shout out to our panelist, Brody Levesque, for actually being the producer of this particular episode. This episode is has a lot of facets to it, and we're going to be covering it from a couple of different angles. But the core of it is the issue of quote, and I mean big quote, unquote, religious freedom. Religious freedom is one of those topics where one side of the equation has taken the verbiage and skewed it to serve their point of view or their image that they would like to convey, even though it isn't exactly accurate as to what it is they're wanting. When in fact, in this case, quote unquote, religious freedom is actually religious imposition, where a certain group of people in our country want to operate their businesses, their lives, and impose their viewpoints on everyone they come in contact with. And that is absolutely not freedom across the board or equality. So tonight, we have, along with our regular panelists, Brody Levesque and Karen Oakham, who are seasoned journalists, we are joined by Zach Ford. Zach is the LGBTQ editor at Think Progress. He has covered marriage equality, transgender rights, education, and quote, big quote, has gone hand-to-hand combat on this online. So we're really anxious to hear his point of view. First, let me bring on our panelists. Good evening, Brody. And good evening,
Rob. How are you?
Hey there,
great.
Rob.
How are you doing? And I want to welcome to the show I want to welcome somebody you guys are well familiar with, new to me, although we've chattered over Twitter. Zach Ford, welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm glad to join you guys tonight.
Oh,
hey, Zach.
Hey, Zach. Hey, Zach.
Oh, you guys.
Okay. So no spit wad throwing, you guys. This is good. We're going to keep it clean. So let's start tonight with the Sessions memo. Brody, do you want to kind of give us an overview of what little boy Jeff Sessions did last?
The Attorney General has framed the argument with his memorandum based on an executive order and based on a few other things that the Trump administration has put together. And a lot of this we're just now finding out is at the behest of the Vice President of the United States and the outside influences of the Family Research Council and the Heritage Foundation, both headquartered there in Washington, where Zach is. Essentially, Sessions has quantified and qualified that religious freedom means that if a person has a strongly held religious conviction, in particular aiming this at LGBTQI folks, but also the way this would work itself out, and I'm being told this by the attorneys at Lambda Legal and the Southern Poverty Law Center, it would also aim it directly at Muslims or any other group where there would be a gray area for interpretation. Sessions' memo more or less is aimed at the government, the federal government, and it's kind of rolling back some of the Obama administration initiatives and things like that. However, it leaves itself open to wider interpretations, and this would also include by the various branches of the Justice Department across the board, in particular the U.S. attorneys in the 12 circuits, it would make it very problematic. In fact, it would make it almost impossible for the Justice Department, in particular the U.S. Attorney's offices, to do any kind of legal advocacy for LGBTQI people in cases that would be brought before them. It just really puts an overshadowing onus on all of this. Sessions has continued to make public statements and pronouncements. He did an interview with a fundamentally a right-wing media outlet that I think, and this is my opinion now, went one step further than that. And again, it's codifying these discriminatory practices. Whether or not it's going to stand up to a legal challenge and a court test remains to be seen, according to the attorneys at the Southern Poverty Law Center, as well as the American Civil Liberties Union. But I'll let Zach get into that. So that's the context of the basic framework of what Sessions has done thus far. And that was codifying more than anything else what the Trump administration had already previously laid out.
Right. Thanks, buddy. Zach, can you, you've written a lot on this. What is your take on the Sessions memo in particular and the depths of the religious, quote-unquote, freedom movement? Where are they right now?
Sure. Well, the Christian conservatives, and generally when we're talking about this, we're largely only talking about evangelical conservative Christians. It's not representative of all Christianity. Even traditional other fellow opponents, like in the marriage equality fight, like the Catholic Church and whatnot, they're really not as big a part of this conversation. They're more involved in the contraception side of the religious freedom piece. But they're very energized and very excited about this, and in part because they helped write these things. We know that Jeff Sessions met with the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a group that has filed suits all over the country trying to overturn LGBTQ non-discrimination protections, and they represent the baker who's going to the Supreme Court and all these other wedding vendors that are fighting for the right to discriminate. The Family Research Council, another anti-LGBTQ hate group, Tony Perkins, the president of that group, has been visiting the White House on a regular basis. The day that this guidance came out, it just so happened FRC was ready to go with a new hotline that they were partnering with some other legal orgs, probably ADF, although they didn't say which orgs, to help identify when someone feels that their religious freedom has been infringed upon. So they were clearly aware that this was coming and ready for it as well. So they're all very engaged. And when you read their content, you see that they know, and they know that their supporters should appreciate that this is anti-LGBTQ intentional. Brian Brown, for example, the president of the National Organization for Marriage, sent an email blast out today saying, "This is so great. This is, you know, directly tied to our goals, opposing marriage equality." So they're all fired up about it. But what's tricky, I guess you might say, is that it doesn't say sexual orientation or gender identity or marriage in the documents themselves, right? They really rely on a lot of dog whistles. So what you have to do is you have to go back and look at what have their goals been with these kinds of initiatives in the past, and what kind of language do they use. And for a while, they kind of had this model where they specifically laid out the kinds of beliefs that they wanted to protect. So you see this in Mississippi's law, HB 1523, which went into effect this week. You see this in the First Amendment Defense Act, which is a bill that's been proposed a couple times in Congress. And you also saw this in the leaked executive order that spilled out in February that ended up not being signed, but again had this language where they specifically said, if you believe that marriage is between a man and a woman, if you believe that sex is, you know, defined by your anatomy at birth, essentially anti-transgender position, and the Mississippi law, at least, also includes a belief against premarital sex, then only those beliefs are protected. Now, in this new guidance, it doesn't say that. This guidance comes from the executive order that President Trump signed in May, which was watered down and kind of only focused on the contraception issue, but also directed Attorney General Sessions to make this, to develop this guidance. And so what we're seeing now is how it's being put into effect.
Yeah, that's it's really interesting, the distinction between those. Karen, I want to ask you about one thing, and this touches on an intersection of your and my path. In West Hollywood, years ago, when West Hollywood became a city, there was a pretty notorious straight bar that was right in the heart of West Hollywood, and for years they had a sign up that said, "No faggots allowed." And they misspelled it, of course, but it was still the verbiage. And when West Hollywood became a city, there was a big ceremony as people went in and took that sign down and didn't allow that. Do you see the progress of these kind of things, if they are successful, that that would send some of those bars putting similar signage back up? What is your take for California?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you're talking about Barney's Beanery, which has long since changed its ways. So just in case anybody Googles, you know, that story. I am not so concerned about how businesses in particular will respond because, you know, they need to go where the money is. And what we've been seeing with the backlash against Georgia and then Indiana and North Carolina, including the NBA and a slew of Fortune 500 companies, is that businesses want to recruit and retain, hire and retain the best and the brightest, and that includes LGBT people. So I think that, and people are, from what I understand it, a lot of businesses are really, they promote where they are on HRC's corporate index. It matters to them. It matters to people who are seeking employment to go on the websites and see whether, what the employee diversity, and personnel handbook might be. So I'm not sure that the public at large or businesses in particular will fall sway to this. I am concerned, and this is one of the things that I wanted to ask Zach about, actually. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Karen.
And by the way, we should mention that please, people go on to thinkprogress.org. Think Progress is all one word. And look up Zach's work because it's really extraordinary. And his explanation of not only the religious liberty, the Sessions memos, but of the breakdown of what's happening with these religious liberty laws and where we're headed with this is really exceptional, including a lot of links to cases and past stories. So he does do footnotes and citations. Zach, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is in the piece that you wrote about, because this parallels a piece that I just did on Vice President Mike Pence, calling him a Christian supremacist. This is your piece of October 6th. Justice Department issues new religious freedom memo that invites anti-LGBTQ discrimination. And in that piece, you have I'm going to read this excerpt. Some conservatives, and this goes back to what you were talking about that leaked memo in February. Some conservatives were upset that it turned out to be so narrow instead. But Fox News's Ted Starnes, a very vocal opponent of LGBTQ equality, was not at all concerned. Quote, "I spoke to a conservative leader late last night, instrumental in crafting the order," he said at the time. "He tells me this is just the first step in a multi-step process. And he tells me President Trump will protect religious freedom for all Americans," end quote. This is regarding the new guidance from Sessions. That speaks to what my reporting suggests, that there is, for lack of a better word, essentially a conspiracy afoot between Tony Perkins, Mike Pence, and all these anti-LGBT groups to essentially, in my analysis, is work towards a theocracy. That's why when you were saying this is a specific evangelical wing of Christianity, I think that you're on point there. But they are tenacious, and they now have a foothold in the Oval Office. They're talking to Donald Trump as if he is, you know, the new David, full of flaws, but he's going to be that great leader who's going to lead them to the promised land, which is why they're putting up with him. And I'm wondering if you see the same thing. I mean, you know, we have the TikTok that shows how Mike Pence, how, you know, Tony Perkins is kind of sort of the new Karl Rove, only with a deeper agenda, not just winning elections, but aiming towards theocracy as a dominionism guy. I'm wondering if you kind of see the same things and see the same kind of parallels, and if you're nervous about it as well.
Oh, totally. I mean, I've been nervous about it since he picked Pence to be his vice presidential nominee, because we knew from the Indiana fight over the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that Pence was a big enemy of ours, and he was going to cater to the social conservatives to both help get their vote and then see through their agenda once they were in office. And, you know, we saw Ken Blackwell, who was a senior fellow at the Family Research Council, was on the transition team. He was the one that, from my sense, was working on these executive orders and things like that. And I think you're totally right. And my colleague, Jack Jenkins, who's our religious reporter at Think Progress, has done a lot of great work unpacking how Trump actually has this religious advisory council, but it's unofficial. It's not listed anywhere. And yet they show up sometimes and they have all of these photo sessions and everything. And it's like, oh, here's this group that doesn't officially exist, but apparently has the ear of the president and is advising him. And when you look at it, it's entirely evangelical Christian. That's the only group that this White House is actually consulting on when they're talking about issues of faith. So they're not talking to mainline Protestants. They're not talking to Catholics. They're not talking to people who are Jewish or Muslim. So there's clearly only one group that's there. And, you know, Trump sort of made this claim that he would be LGBT friendly, or even in a broader sense, that he just didn't care quite as much about social issues. And what that means is he's fine to go along with whatever supports his base, and his base is conservative. And so, you know, he just doesn't really care about the consequences of these things. Like, it seems clear from the reporting that Tony Perkins was the one who recommended he ban transgender people from serving in the military, and he just did it sort of on a whim after he received that counsel from Perkins. So, you know, it's not clear that he cares what the outcomes are. He only kind of cares if his base is happy. And so I think you're exactly right. The evangelical Christians have a stronghold on this White House, and they're getting everything that they want.
I think Brody
right,
wants to
and
ask
it's
you
not,
further
it's
about
not
that.
Just, it's not just faith issues. I think that we need to be, you know, kind of clear about that, because they may be a faith advisory group, but it extrapolates, it extends out, as you just pointed out, to military issues. That small group that laid their hands on germaphobe President Donald Trump, you know, has upended the military. So Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis, has to turn his attention to this absurd reversal of the current policy while we're facing a potential crisis with North Korea.
Brody, you had a point?
Yeah, Zach, I'm going to go a little bit narrower, and I'm going to talk about the trans ban. Some of the reporting that Karen did, and some of the reporting that I did as well, along with my sources. What's happening, we're seeing this, is that the evangelicals suddenly have, you know, a serious grip within this administration. During the process with the Hartzler Amendment, we did have Secretary Mattis reach out and speak with, I guess you would call them moderate Republicans. But when push came to shove, even after the Hartzler Amendment was shot down and they decided to do an end run around it,
was a maneuver that the House leadership wasn't comfortable with. It caused the chair of the Freedom Caucus, Congressman Meadows and Hartzler and a few of these others, to go to Tony Perkins and to complain and to see what they could do. And they took that, we're being told from our sources, directly into the White House. Now, I'm, again, referring specifically to the trans ban. In a narrower sense, also, we're now being told that there are two or three very high-ranking members of the chaplain corps that are also very much actively involved with not just the Family Research Council, but apparently a couple of these other evangelical organizations, and including the Heritage Foundation, although it's not a religious organization per se. But, you know, the types of policy wonks and the people that are there, as you know, because you cross swords with Brian Anderson all the time on Twitter. But this is the type of thing that, you know, to Karen's point, we're seeing more and more and more of it. Now, I don't know what your sources are telling, you know, you at this point, but it seems to me that they now have a ticket with the administration. And although Trump seems to be the face of it, I'm being told that a great deal of this is coming through the vice president, and it's also giving White House Chief of Staff General Kelly some serious headache. Do you want to comment on that?
I can't personally speak to those sorts of insider things. I don't have any more knowledge on those than you do. But I think that, you know, it's not a surprise that Pence has been involved. I did similarly see that, you know, when the Hartzler Amendment was failing, he was the one over there trying to wrangle votes and things like that. But also, you know, we have to remember this is also Jeff Sessions in the position of Attorney General, who has all of these same beliefs and is very eager to enact them. So we can't let him off the hook. He was actually just on with David Brody on the Christian Broadcast Network this week, openly admitting that
right.
he has his own position that the baker should be allowed to refuse service, that it's not a compelling government interest to protect against discrimination based on sexual orientation, which isn't actually, you know, the Department of Justice filed a brief siding with the baker in the Supreme Court case.
Mm-hmm.
The argument that they made in the brief was a non-religious argument. It focused on the whole is a cake speech argument, whereas what Sessions expressed in his interview was this religious argument that because, you know, Jack Phillips has this belief about same-sex marriage, he shouldn't be forced to have to make the cake. So it's sort of interesting that, like, it was very clear that that was Sessions' belief and not just the position of the DOJ.
I wanted to ask you
okay.
three about something along the lines of these principles. We had a situation in Seattle this past week where the tables were turned on this, where the business owner came out with religious people in his establishment and said, it may have been Portland, but it was northwest. But essentially, threw them out of his business, not wanting to do business with them based on his deeply held beliefs against them. What is the three of your take on that kind of reversal? Is that a way to protest this, or is that putting bad after bad?
Well, I can happily jump in on this because as soon as it happened, I had friends from the Heritage Foundation trolling me saying, Zach, why isn't this the same thing? And what's your position? And, you know, I even want to kind of object to how you framed it, because it was not about belief. It's not a parallel example at all. The way that I would recommend people think about this, and any of you have other thoughts, you can add to it. Business owners do have the right to refuse service to anybody in general. The law only carves out exceptions for reasons that you can't refuse service. So you can't refuse service based on race, based on religion, and different states have added different categories, including sexual orientation and gender identity in some. So the reason that this gay cafe owner kicked this group out is not only were they an anti-abortion group who had just been around flyering, they were also an anti-LGBT group. This was a group that opposed his very well-being, and they were in his own space. So what he did was, it was not that he was removing them because of beliefs. He was removing them. Mm-hmm. The issue is not whether or not you're allowed to remove someone because of beliefs. The issue is whether or not you're allowed to remove someone who is a member of a protected class. And being anti-choice is not a protected class. Even in the few places that have a political protection, like Washington, D.C., that refers generally to party membership, not just whatever you happen to believe on a certain issue. So there's a very big difference between asking people to leave your establishment and refusing them service for having reprehensible beliefs versus refusing them service simply because of a core aspect of their identity, as we've seen in the wedding vendor cases.
Okay, what if, okay. Zach, I've got a hypothetical, though, for you. I'm a parent. That's a big deal for me, and I adopted through foster care. If I were to create my own adoption agency, it might be one that caters to kids who are LGBT identified, transgender, gender fluid. And if I went into the public space and I didn't want people who were of a religion to adopt these kids because my fear would be that they would have an agenda, is that okay?
Well, in that case,
I'm just out of luck.
You're working to do what's in the best interest of the child. And some states are now even, incorporating policy for child placement services that say, if you are not LGBT affirming, we're not going to trust you with these children. If anything, the law is moving towards supporting you in that regard. Because, again, you're not, when you're refusing service to somebody, there's a difference between whether it's based on their identity or whether it's based on their beliefs and actions. And that's not the same thing. And just because they, have a certain idea doesn't mean that that's the core of their religious identity either. So I think that it's an interesting hypothetical, but it still comes down to, are you refusing service to an entire class of people? Are you refusing to serve all Christians, or are you only refusing to place children in environments that would not be safe and healthy for them? I think that's an easy line to draw.
Okay. Karen, you had another question?
Yeah, mine is also kind of a legal question as well. When you were talking about, the Sessions memo and the Sessions guidance, you said in your piece, by claiming there's no compelling interest to protect against anti-gay discrimination, Sessions is actually sounding a dog whistle that sexual orientation is less deserving of protection than other categories like race. That's because the Supreme Court has long concluded that protecting against discrimination is, in fact, a compelling interest. Even in his decision concluding that RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, protects Hobby Lobby from having to provide contraception coverage to its female employees, even the very conservative Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito wrote that religion should not justify discrimination, at least when it comes to race. So here's the nut of the issue for me. To the best of my knowledge, we are not really a protected class, are we? I mean, that was one of the things that I know that the Prop 8 case was trying to do. The federal was to get the Supreme Court to essentially come out and say it's not just rational basis, but that the government has a compelling interest to protect sexual orientation and gender identity as a protected class. And I'm not sure that that exists. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I think that might really screw us.
Sure. Well, it's confusing because there are a lot of different pieces that fit into that puzzle. So first thing you said is absolutely correct. There's no protection at the federal level that explicitly protects sexual orientation and gender identity from discrimination. We've tried to add it for a long time. For the long time, we fought over just ENDA to only do it for employment. We now have the Equality Act to try to lay it out for both for employment and housing and public accommodations. But in this Congress, it's obviously going nowhere. Now, there are states, however, that do have, at the state level, non-discrimination protections that do protect sexual orientation and gender identity. And so that's actually where we see these cases popping up, like Colorado and Oregon and Washington and New Mexico. Those are states that have state-level protections. And so the cases are actually going through state court, and when the Supreme Court's at the state level rule, then they get appealed to the federal Supreme Court. So the federal Supreme Court's being asked in the Baker case to weigh in on a state law, not a federal law. So it's sort of a tricky position. You're absolutely right that even in Obergefell, Justice Kennedy was sort of careful not to explicitly offer what we generally call heightened scrutiny to sexual orientation. When we're talking about different levels of scrutiny, we're talking about how do you weigh what the law says against what the people experience. And for race, we have the highest level of scrutiny. For sex, we have an intermediate level of scrutiny. So different classes are often weighed in different ways because of just the way those identities play out in society. And so we don't have a concrete federal answer to that question. But it almost doesn't matter because it is written into the state law, and that's what the court will be tasked with analyzing.
But then it can be extrapolated out, right? I mean, when you say, because you've been saying, and that is clarifies it, that you're talking about the state in this Baker case, that, you know, they're targeting a specific class. But when you step back and you look at it on a federal level, for instance, targeting the transgender community in these, you know, transgender military cases, they are specifically targeting a class of people, but not a protected class of people. And, you know, religious liberty laws, if we, you know, if we get a religious liberty law, or if they're upheld in all these other cases, can be extrapolated to say, well, you know, we have a right to kick them out. I mean, it's really screwy when we talk about targeting a specific group or class of people.
Sure. So I want to just answer that quickly. I know Brody has a comment too, but just to sort of clarify, there is a separate kind of fight happening in some federal courts right now to address the question of whether or not sex, which is protected under federal law, applies to cases involving sexual orientation and gender identity. And I think the argument in favor of both is very strong. For example, if you are fired because you have a wife, but a man who was fired or a man who has a wife wasn't fired, that's discrimination on the basis of sex. Yes, you know, he has a sexual orientation and you as a woman would have a sexual orientation or whatever, but you're still making this distinction based on sex. Likewise, for gender identity, the example that I gave, which actually was used by a judge in a lower court ruling back in 2008, you know, if you had an employer who happily employed Christians and happily employed people who were Jewish, but believed that conversion was wrong, and so if you had converted from one to the other or in either direction, he would discriminate against you, any judge would easily see that that is still discrimination on the basis of religion. So if you're refusing to hire or promote, or you're firing somebody for not being the sex that they were born as, that transition should be counted as sex the same way a conversion counted as religion. So those cases are also playing out, and they haven't reached the Supreme Court yet, but there have been a number of lower court rulings where the judges found that sex did encompass these LGBTQ identities. So there is room for all of that to play out, but that question hasn't gotten to the Supreme Court yet. So we don't they won't necessarily answer that question in the Baker case.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, then let's move then to Mississippi, Zach. Let's talk about House Bill 1523, which was signed into law by Governor Phil Bryant last year. It went through several court challenges, and finally, the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals went ahead and in its ruling let it go. Washington Blade senior political correspondent and White House reporter Chris Johnson writes, "The law prohibits the state from taking action against religious organizations that decline employment, housing, or services to same-sex couples, families who've adopted a foster child and wish to act in opposition to same-sex marriage, and or individuals who offer wedding services and decline to facilitate a same-sex wedding. Additionally, the bill allows individuals working in medical services to decline a transgender person's request for gender reassignment surgery. The bill is also allowing the state government employees of Mississippi to facilitate marriages to opt out of issuing licenses, et cetera, et cetera." Now, Reverend Jasmine Beach Ferraro, who's the executive director of the Campaign for Southern Equality, spelled it out to Chris this way. I quote Reverend Ferraro: "The insidious power of a law like this is that it casts a long shadow over public life, forcing someone to assess whether or not they will be treated fairly and respectfully in situations from the crisis of the emergency room to an anniversary dinner at a restaurant to a child's classroom. Now we face the real cruel reality of a law going into effect and the imminent threat it poses to the dignity, health, and well-being of LGBT Mississippians." Now, granted, this one's headed obviously to SCOTUS, but in a larger context, this kind of is on the shopping list for these evangelicals. You know, I've watched a lot, especially in the trans issues, you going back and forth with Brian Anderson at Heritage, and you guys have both talked about this. Give me just your impression for a second, because this is kind of specific, and this is in the broader sense what we're looking at. Because you and I both know that even if it doesn't fall within, say, the equivalent of the Sessions memo, it's the impression and the overall overarching license, if you will, okay, that kind of thing leaves in people's minds. And then you have a law like this in Mississippi, even though it's being challenged, that in a sense does the same thing. And granted, you know, obviously this thing's probably not going to make it through a court challenge, but I want to ask you about that. You want to comment, please?
Sure. I mean, the first thing to keep in mind is that as odious as this law is in text, it doesn't actually change the status quo in Mississippi, because when it passed, there were no protections at the state level for LGBTQ people, and there were no even cities that protected it. I believe Jackson has since passed some protections, but otherwise it was legal to discriminate throughout Mississippi anyway, which is why I think that the language of a license to discriminate, or I've even found it maybe even more accurate to say an invitation to discriminate, is because of these laws are basically saying, here's all of the ways we want to make sure that you know how to discriminate, and really just sort of encouraging that behavior and creating that kind of culture. So there's a real toxicity to it. But I think what's particularly troublesome for those who want to keep this law in the books is the fact that it lays out specific beliefs that it protects. Like, it might actually have survived a challenge much better, and it still might survive a challenge. I mean, I think it was the Fifth Circuit that went ahead and said, we're okay with this. But when it was defeated at the lower court first, the lower court judge was like, look, if you're going to set aside one set of beliefs for protection while you're not doing anything for people who believe differently on those issues, that's basic violation of the Establishment Clause, right? You're basically saying this is a state-sanctioned religious belief and this isn't. So to have it a law being challenged in this way that is so explicit, my hope is that if the Supreme Court ends up considering it, they recognize how poorly written it is in that sense. But it could very well be that it loses and then everyone says, oh, all we need to do is not write it in a way that specifically protects one thing. But if we write it in a neutral way, we'll know that it's still meant to only protect the people who are going to discriminate, because it doesn't work in both directions, because the other side's not trying to discriminate. You don't have like gay businesses that are trying to refuse service to clients just because they're straight. So it still would only help the bad guys, but they might learn from this law, if it's shot down, how to write those laws better. But in the meantime, like, it's really unclear what the fate of this law is, and for now it's on the books.
Right. I acknowledge that. I just think the only thing that I guess the point that I'm making, because this is something that I keep looking at, is that I'm looking at the efforts that are being put forth and put into this by these family values, religious organizations, and again, I will use your terminology because I completely agree with it, the evangelical Pentecostal groups, but they're codifying this. And, you know, if they get, it's like whack-a-mole, okay? If it comes through and SCOTUS does agree to hear it, you know, strikes it down, it's almost as if, okay, well, we didn't get it here. We're going to come back. We're going to rewrite this thing and try it someplace else. And as long as we've got the Trump-Pence administration and the Attorney General of the United States covering us in a broader sense, we're just going to keep at it. And again, the reason I'm saying that, as you know, because I'm sure you're probably going to go, is IU Voters is this weekend. And that's where the who's who of that movement will be. And for the first time ever, a sitting president has agreed to address these people that we're actually talking about. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to take it out of the legal realm and more into the popular opinion realm, because that drives so much of the political constituency and how these things get propelled. The first thing is that there is kind of a mindset in a lot of the American public, and Zach, you alluded to this a few minutes ago, of the small business right to not have to do business with somebody they don't want to. And I've talked to a lot of small business owners who, you know, are progressive people. I mean, they're politically progressive, but they too relate to that concept of them not having to do business with just anybody who walks in the door. And states are not consistent about the laws that where there are protections. For example, the photographer in New Mexico, that went all the way to the Supreme Court there. They had actually a pretty intelligent ruling about that. But that person, had they been in California, would not, that business, that type of business, is not covered by those kind of anti-discrimination statutes. So she could have done exactly what she did in California, and there wouldn't have been a law to cover it. But there's this public sentiment that is, it's your business. You should be able to do business with who you want to do business with. And if they don't like it, they can go somewhere else. And to Karen's point, the money will sort this out, because you're making a choice that is economically not feasible. What would you say to address that public mindset?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that the consistency across states is a problem, but it's not one that we're really equipped to solve short of Congress passing a law that applies nationwide. But the thing is, when you look at the polling, people from all stripes overwhelmingly oppose letting business owners like Jack Phillips refuse service on the basis of their sexual orientation. And in fact, along religious lines, it's only white evangelical Protestants where a majority support that kind of discrimination. I'm glancing at numbers that just came out a few weeks ago from the Public Religious Research Institute. And along political lines, you know, 67% of Republicans support legal anti-gay discrimination, but only 40% of independents and 24% of Democrats. And generally, white people are far more likely to support discrimination than any of the other racial groups, which I think goes back to what Karen was talking about earlier, that people recognize the parallel between discrimination on the basis of race and discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And the fact that Black Americans and Hispanic Americans are far more likely to, you know, far less likely to defend the baker, I think shows a recognition of that parallel, that you know, you don't tell the black students that they can't eat at the lunch counter just because there's another lunch counter that serves them. That harms them and violates, you know, our due process in our open society in the same way that telling the gay couple to go to another bakery does.
Mm-hmm. Karen?
I have a follow-up question, especially in terms of the popularity stuff. You know, we're so enmeshed in this. We know what the Family Research Council is. We know who all these the Heritage Foundation, we know who all these groups are. But I'm not sure that the general population does. I think that they may know more about the Southern Poverty Law Center. They may know more about the ACLU. But I'm not sure that they really know or care about Tony Perkins. We see them, Tony Perkins and, you know, FRC and these guys, as now being more powerful, especially because they have a foothold in the Oval Office. I mean, a for real foothold this time, not just Karl Rove whispering to, you know, what is it, born again George W. Bush. This is like a real thing. And all of those evangelicals who are in the cabinet, and they're not just, you know, they're dominionism. That is a specific extreme right Christian supremacy. So that's real, but we know about that. The general population does not. How much power do you think the Family Research Council actually has?
Well,
I mean,
you know,
do they sway Congress as much as we think they do? I mean, Freedom Caucus, you know, maybe, but I mean, how powerful are they really?
Well, you know, I always engage with these folks because my hope is that they, whoever their followers are, see their exchange with me and either see what I said or at least see what I provoked them to say, because usually they have polished talking points. You know, this was a thing that, you know, we've been tracking Perkins for years, where he would go on MSNBC for who knows why and say these very nice things and pretend he's speaking on behalf of, like, all Christians in the country. And then he would go on his own radio show and say some of the nastiest and most bigoted things. And he was the same person, right? And so we have to kind of be careful that they might be swindling people into, you know, believing things. And just, this is sort of like a different example, but we keep seeing all of these situations where schools are trying to figure out how to take care of transgender kids. And what seems to be like this process is the school does the right thing, recognizes the kid in their gender identity, lets them use the name and pronouns in bathroom that match that identity, and everything's fine. And then some bigoted parents in the school find out about it, get upset, teach their own kids to reject the student, gang up on the school board, and create this influx that suggests that because they're loud, they speak for all people. And they're actually a small group, but they're very motivated by the sort of fear that they have by their lack of understanding on these issues. And even though they might be a small pocket of a group, in that community, they can do a lot of harm to that kid, to that family, and to the fate of that school. And so I think we just have to sort of recognize that the places like the Family Research Council, places like ADF that give locals legal counsel and support, groups like Heritage that, you know, create these messages and you know, sort of pose as think tanks to hand out these talking points, they're equipping folks at the local level to do harm and to reinforce their ignorance and their fears about these issues and just about who LGBTQ people are. And so it might not matter if people know who Tony Perkins is, but when an issue comes up in their school and they want help and they turn to the Alliance Defending Freedom, suddenly it matters a whole lot what the Alliance Defending Freedom stands for, who their partners are, and what they're advocating. So that's, you know, you and I, Karen, have tracked these people all day long because we know it's important to keep on top of what they're dispensing. But I think the bigger question is what happens when it does reach people, and that doesn't always come directly from, you know, that face or that name.
Yes.
Brody,
totally
you got a
agree.
Question?
Thank you.
Yeah, Zach, and a follow-up specific to that, you just went to the I despise calling it a seminar. How about a symposium that was put on? You had actually tweeted about it. Unfortunately, I got busy doing other things and couldn't follow back through with it. It seems to me that a lot of the principal focus by Heritage, FRC, focus on the family, along with their friends in the legal world at ADF and Liberty Counsel, is to continue to spread this bad messaging, this faulty messaging, this flawed, in some cases, you know, pseudoscience, if you will, or pseudo-medical science, if nothing else. The question I have for you is that what, you know, as reporters, what can we do to make people far more aware of the damage that these people are doing? Because it is, in fact, mostly, you know, based on religious foundations as opposed to real medical sciences, particularly as what happened with that symposium. My dear friend Kathy Baldock, who, like you and Karen, spends a lot of time engaging with these folk, also saw that happening, because especially with the trans community, there's just so much bad information that these people promulgate and put out there. Would you care to comment, please?
Absolutely. You know, this goes back to a thing that you were, a point you were getting to earlier, Brody, which is, think about the abortion issue. When Roe v. Wade was decided, all of the conservatives who oppose abortion had to say, okay, we can't actually outlaw abortion again. So what can we do to keep people from getting abortions? And we've now seen decades of all kinds of different restrictions that they placed on abortion clinics and forcing women to, you know, get ultrasounds and listen to messages and all kinds of crap to try to discourage abortion. And so with, you know, the victories that we've had, like marriage equality, we're seeing social conservatives embrace the same sort of tactic where they're saying, okay, we lost the big question of whether same-sex couples can get married, but like, what are the other tactics that we can use to curb that? Can we find ways to make sure that we can still operate our own adoption agencies that use, you know, government funding but refuse service to same-sex couples? So we're seeing cases like that. How can we make sure that we can still discriminate in employment and in businesses, like the Baker case? And how can we push back on trans rights, since that's the next big thing and people are getting more educated about that, and trans kids, and that's coming up in our schools? And so I think it's, you know, it's our job to be the wonks and know the ins and outs of the science and the law as each of these issues play out. But I think what we need people to sort of just grasp is there's a full multifaceted approach to try to, you know, infringe on LGBT equality in every different little space that they can, and recognize it when it happens. Because if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile, and we don't want them to do that. So we they're creating a game of whack-a-mole for us to play. I think that that's a really apt description of it, but we just need to help people understand what that looks like and how it's going to affect their families and their communities.
Thanks, Zach. I appreciate that. Rob?
And
yeah.
Could I just add a little quick thing? Michelangelo Signorelli wrote a whole book about what Zach just described. It's called Victory Blindness. And he talks about how the religious right is doing to us what they did after Roe v. Wade. So I think that that's a really apt point. And for anybody who wants to dig a little deeper, I suggest you pick up Michelangelo Signorelli's book, Victory Blindness.
And I would second that, if only because he cited me in it, too, and I was very excited by that.
there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Zach, I wanted to ask you, you made a reference early on about how the people that are propelling this step forward are a certain aspect of the Christian population of the United States. And a lot of the people who are standing up to go against this are the separation of church and state, philosophical people and legal people getting involved and arguing it down. My question to you is, what is going on with that middle group, the like the Episcopalians or other religious groups who are not looking to discriminate, who are having this stuff put forward kind of in their name, and that if it did get into a culture war where retaliation was going to be done, I mean, they're going to be smirched with the evangelical side. Why are they not speaking out harder, firmer, or are they and we're just not hearing it?
Well, they are and we're just not hearing it, and that's not something new. I mean, we have always had an amazing progressive faith community, and this is not as much my area of expertise. I'm an out and proud atheist, and so I don't track other faith groups as much, but my colleague Jack does, and he does a fine job of it too. But, you know, there was one time that GLAAD actually tracked how religion was represented on news shows, on the cable news networks, and found that the representation of, you know, Tony Perkins and his ilk of super conservative evangelical Christians were vastly outrepresenting any of the other progressive faith leaders. And so you just had this, we've created this public mindset that there's only one version of Christianity and there's only one group of Christians, and they vote as a block and they think as a block. And that's just not true. The problem is, for whatever reason, when these progressive voices of faith speak up, and they do, they just don't get highlighted in the same regard, and they don't get invited to give the interviews, and they don't get invited to speak on behalf of their congregations in the same way. And, you know, it's a real shame. And there's also, because this is my baby point to make, there is this growing, very powerful or ready to be powerful secular movement with groups from the most radical atheists who like to go on Fox News and rile people up to the Satanists who are delightful and coming up with witty ways to try to take advantage of religious freedom and undermine what conservatives are trying to do. And then just other groups like the Secular Student Alliance, who's working with college students who, you know, don't align with the faith or think of themselves more as non-believers, that are, you know, not only is this movement growing, but the population of people who don't really identify with the strong faith tradition is growing, and they're completely invisible. And that's why I try to, you know, own my identity and speak out in that way, because there's a huge block of people that just aren't charged into the opportunity to make a difference. And, you know, I think we're worse off for it.
Good point.
Brody, you had a point?
Okay. Yeah, this is a kind of an ending statement as we're kind of running out of time. I'd like our listeners and for Karen and me, our readers, to follow Zach. He can be followed, Zach Ford, on Twitter at Zach Ford or at thinkprogress.org. I've known Zach for an incredibly long period of time, almost 10 years now. He's an incredible editor and journalist, as well as an advocate, and it will be well worth your time checking his work out, Rob.
Great. Zach, I want to thank you very much for being part of the show. Your voice is important both to the community and to our discussion tonight, obviously, but the bigger picture is the community, and your work there is phenomenal. And I echo Brody's sentiment for people to check you out and follow you on Twitter and all of that sort of good stuff. I also want to thank Brody and Karen for being part of our – I'm sorry?
If I could just say thank you first for all your flattering words, but also to any of your listeners, if you have questions, I love to engage with folks. I'm a teacher by trade, not a journalist. And so if you heard something tonight that you have a question about or something else that I wrote, please feel free to reach out. I'm happy to engage with you on a one-on-one case.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Also, I want to tell our listeners to listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com. Saturday, 7 p.m. This weekend, I'm interviewing artist Paul Richmond and author Eric Rosswood. And to Zach's point, he's talking about a book, The Ultimate Gay Dad Guide, and I'm in that book. So, yeah, we love it when we get mentioned. Thank you for listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We'll be back again this time next week, 7 p.m. Pacific Time Thursdays. and 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Come back, join us then, another exciting show.